Now, according to the program, the next speaker is Gerard Norton, but unfortunately Gerard was not able to make this seminar. He was called away urgently on a business matter. But we do have a more than adequate replacement in Alan Jacobs. Alan Jacobs is the Senior International Economist and Strategist at AMP Capital Investors. He's been with the AMP and AMP Capital Investors for 20 years. During the time, he's spent over 16 years monitoring trends in the US, Japanese and European economies, stock markets and bond markets. He's also spent 3.5 years as the Asia Pacific and Emerging Market Economist and Strategist. His present responsibilities are directly related to the asset allocation function of AMP Capital Investments, where he is responsible for views on international trends in economic growth, inflation, interest rates, currencies, bond yields, corporate profits growth, and stock market valuations. So, Alan, thanks very much for joining us, and he's going to address us on ageing populations and investment markets.
Thank you, Martin. Now, as you can see, folks, I'm at the cutting edge of the baby boom, and all this talk about graveyards has got me unsettled. Folks, I'm just going to touch on demographics again. I'm sure that you've had a gutful of it this morning, but just to make sure that one or two points have been touched on. In the past century, the proportion of population aged over 64 has increased from 4% to 13% in 2004. This trend continues. By 2020, the population profile will have aged further. Life expectancy will have increased. The dependency ratio will have reached a troubling level. Growth rate in the population of working age will have slowed, a matter of some importance. And migration will help but not solve the problem. I don't intend to go into this much further. Now, just looking at the baby boom bulge, we know that rising life expectancy and declining fertility have meant the population has aged. The aging of the baby boom following declining birth rates has meant a bulge moving through the population. Now, the point I just want to draw your attention to, sorry about the folks on that side of the room, is look at the gap between where we are today and where we'll be tomorrow. And what that means for the younger cohorts and the older cohorts. And you can see that the growth rate in the older cohorts is going to be perhaps 2 to 3 times greater than the growth rate in the younger cohorts, i.e., if you look at people from age about 55 and over, their growth in the population will be about 3 times greater than the growth in people in the order of 20, 25, 30. Now, that has some impact on the investment outlook. Now, this chart appeared in the press about 2 years ago, and it relates the share of population accounted for by 40 to 65-year-olds with real stock prices. That red line is the proportion of the population of 40 to 65-year-olds. Why that cohort? Because they are typically the highest earning, the wealthiest, and the highest saving portion of the population. And the argument is as that cohort rises as a percent of the population, then overall saving and investment in the population rises, and that pushes up real asset prices. On the other hand, as that cohort in the population diminishes, then that will reduce saving and investment in the population, and by implication with this forecast, it will reduce real stock prices and reduce real returns in the future. Now, when this came out 2 years ago, it caused a bit of concern, and therefore the people at AMP asked me to investigate this. And my initial knee-jerk reaction was, well, that was a deceptively good correlation. If you re-express that as percentage changes, as I have in this chart, in effect, the correlation isn't nearly as good. You know, that was only good to the untrained eye. And in particular, if you look at it post-1981, and I've got some T-stats and R-squareds on the right-hand side of the chart, you can see that in the period 1982 to 2004, the R-squared is only 0.08, and the T-stat is 1.3, which is not significant. So, purely from a statistical point of view, that was a questionable relationship. I mean, if something works well on levels, it should work well on percentage changes also. And the problem with levels taken over a long period of time when they drift up is they can be exaggerated. Anyway, AMP weren't comforted by that observation, and so we decided to do a much more in-depth analysis and study of this whole topic. And just let me go quickly through the conclusions and then talk about some of them in more detail. Now, the first conclusion is that economic growth should slow in the long term. The aged lobby will gain increasing influence, both political, economic, and financial. The savings rate will fall, but that people on average will not decumulate, i.e. will not consume their savings. We use the term decumulate as opposed to the opposite of accumulate. And this is a key thing, and we'll discuss that in more detail. Asset valuations will probably deteriorate a bit as a result of higher interest rates and bond yields, but in our judgment should not become unduly depressed. Empirical studies, in fact, found little support for a direct link between demographic change and asset class returns. Past and present, there is no obvious preference amongst the retired cohort for fixed interest versus stocks and real estate, which I think is an observation that challenges some common thinking these days. And we concluded that some combination of yield and inflation protection is desired by our customers in retirement. Now, let's look at the slower economic growth thing. Why should we expect slower economic growth? Well, firstly, we're going to have slower population growth. I think this is almost a given for low birth rates, ageing, et cetera, et cetera. You've been there before. With respect to the workforce, we could also point out that you'll probably have a falling participation rate. I think it's unlikely that people over the age of 65 will really become significant participators in the workforce. And even to the extent that they do, my guess is that their productivity will be lower than it was when they were 40 and 45. So overall, slower population growth, slower workforce growth. That inhibits both demand and output growth. Now, less saving implies higher real rates of interest. I'll illustrate that for you in a minute. It implies a higher cost of capital, and that implies less investment, especially as investment will be facing lower growth rates. So you have lower growth rates, higher cap rates, less investment. The tax base also probably faces some erosion because the proportion of the population in the workforce will shrink relative to that portion of the population not in the workforce. That's the dependency ratio. So we face the probability of some tax base erosion and, of course, increased spending on pensions and healthcare. That therefore brings with it a risk of higher taxes. I say a risk, not a certainty. Depends who the Minister of Finances at that time. We estimate, on the basis of these factors, that long-term growth will slow to between 2.75% and 3% in Australia in the period 2015 to 2020, as opposed to 3.6% in the past decade. Call it between 0.5% and 0.75%. Now, of course, that's anything but a certainty. There's all kinds of things we can't foresee. The big assumption is really changing productivity. What government policies will be, what new technologies will be, what might develop with respect to overseas economies, China, India, Southeast Asia, growth in the rest of the world, etc. So this is really an uncertain forecast, but I think the general tendency will be for growth to slow a bit. Some implications, related and not related, is that, of course, the structure of growth will shift in favour of services. Elderly people want services rather than goods. The slower workforce growth could also lead to upwards pressure on wages, i.e. as we have a smaller workforce in the economy, it could be some reallocation of relative prices. Pressure on wages isn't necessarily inflationary. Inflation means a rise in all prices. Here we're talking about the probability of the returns to labour rising versus the returns to capital. Right? Productivity, as I've mentioned, will become a key issue. Automation, mechanisation, computerisation will, I think, be a big focus in the future. But it will be difficult in some of the expanding industries of healthcare and aged care, which really depend on individual personal attention. Just flicking through this quickly, effects on business generally. Well, rising wages, higher real interest rates, possible higher taxes, slower GDP growth, are a bit of a witch's brew. They don't, aren't really positive for the business outlook. So you would expect that profits growth in the outer years will be dragged down. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, but taking it from, say, 2015 onwards, this kind of effect might start to become a little bit more evident. Now, returns, therefore, should be lower, business returns and investment returns. The losers, in particular within the economy, I think will be real estate, left bums on seats, as we put it, post the year 2020. Education and childcare will be losing industries. Retailing of consumer goods, I think, will lose in favour of the provision of services. Winners will be healthcare, pharmaceuticals, aged care services, as I've mentioned, automation suppliers and technology suppliers, who may be able to provide solutions to shortages in the workforce and aged care, etc. And, of course, our industry, financial advice, financial products, financial planners, etc. Now, let's get on to more substantive things, the savings rate issues. There's a thing called the life cycle hypothesis, which I'm sure you're all aware of, an hypothesis brought down many years ago, I think by Milton Friedman. The idea was that people are born, they have nothing, they spend the next 30, 40, 50 years of their life working, saving, accumulating. In the early years, they spend a lot of money, buy houses, furniture, motor cars. Then in their more mature years, the kids are out of school, they're in the workforce, thank God, I'm almost there. And they start saving, and they invest a lot, and they accumulate a lot of assets. Finally, when they retire, they spend this money and support themselves in retirement. Well, the concept of spend this money is something we have to investigate. However you look at it, we should have a falling savings rate. More retirees, less workers does imply a falling savings rate. Evidence does support the hypothesis for less household savings as the population ages. In addition to that, the pressure on the budget that we've mentioned, whether it's to reduce the surplus or increase the deficit, implies less national saving. So we have less household saving, less national saving. This saving implies higher real interest rates and therefore lower valuations on financial assets generally. Now, the key issue, does living or saving mean decumulation? Does living or saving simply mean living off the income on your savings, or does it mean consuming your savings also? Well, decumulation is a common presumption in what's called simulation models. We'll talk about this in due course and in more detail and explain what those are. However, there is no empirical support, I might say. We surveyed a huge amount of academic research and relied on other surveys of academic research and were unable to find any substantive support for this hypothesis. Most savings, and well, there's a whole raft of reasons for this, but I think the most important one is that most savings are held by the so-called rich, who will not sell their assets. Here in Australia, Data Monitor estimates that just 6% of the population holds 66% of the liquid wealth in 2003. Most wealthy people have enough wealth to live off the income on their wealth. They don't need to accumulate to consume their assets. Certainly, we didn't see Kerry Packer consume his assets. Said he gave them all to James, and I figure that Frank Lowy will do the same, and so will a whole lot of other wealthy people. Thus, we do not expect asset prices to become unduly depressed. We don't expect there to be a wave of decumulation of assets. With respect to people who are less wealthy, they have income support, they have pensions, rental support, healthcare support, etc. They won't necessarily need to decumulate their assets, and those assets also represent their aged security, and we can talk a bit more about this later. But in my understanding of it, people are very loath to part with their security. Here in Australia, there is some limited evidence for lower savings in the retired cohort. I say limited because the Melbourne Institute surveys are not strictly geared to the needs of the study, so we have to make do with what's available. But in this survey, which says, ask households who, you know, how many of you are drawing on your savings, we have this response. And as you can see, that in the later years, in the 55, 64, 65 plus cohorts, there is a modest rise in the percentage of households who say that they are drawing on their savings. Even then, it only goes up to about 2%. You might wonder, is that really significant? It is limited evidence. So logic and some limited empirical evidence does suggest that we should expect some slowdown or some diminution of savings in retirement. Now, just... Oh, sorry, I keep pressing the wrong button. Now, Just to bore you with some economics, which I hope doesn't confuse the issue more than enlighten it, I expected there to be one screen today so I could point a few things out to you, but I'll try. Now, on the vertical axis of this chart, we have the real bond yield. And on the horizontal axis of this chart, we have GDP growth. And the first line there, which is number one, this curve over here, is what we call a savings function. It relates real economic growth to the real bond yield. And as you can see, it slopes upward to the right, i.e., as the growth rate rises, the increase rate rises. A pretty obvious relationship. I'm sure you're all familiar with that one. And let's take point X on that chart, which you see over here. Point X as being where we are today. We have a particular rate of growth and a particular level of real interest rates taken on average over the business cycle. Now, what happens when we have less saving in society? Well, the savings function shifts to the left, to number two. And if the rate of growth that we have today were to be unchanged, then, as you can see, that would correspond with a higher rate of interest. Okay? Savings shifts leftwards. The point of equilibrium is at a higher real rate of interest. But of course, as we said, growth won't remain unchanged in the years ahead. Growth will probably slow. And as growth probably slows, then the interest rate is not entirely determinable from where we are today, but it will be at a lower point on that curve. So, as growth slows, the point of equilibrium will fall down on that curve until we have a new point of equilibrium. Now, we don't know how much growth will slow, but what I can tell you is that for each and every given rate of growth, that the rate of interest will be higher. Right? For that rate of growth, that would have been the rate of interest. For maybe this rate of growth, which is a bit slower, right, that would have been the rate of interest, but this will be the rate of interest. So it might yet be that in future years we have roughly the same rate of interest, but a slower rate of growth. Right? And it's the relationship with the rate of interest to the rate of growth that's important for investors. Because we discount future rates of growth at today's rate of interest. Now, I've relied quite heavily on the work of Professor James Perturber from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston, who's really, I think, one of the major authorities on the study of what demographics changes mean for financial markets. And he presents us here with this chart based on the U.S. periodic surveys of consumer finances, and the U.S. do a very thorough job of their surveys of households. It's what we call age-specific net financial assets. It's a snapshot at a point in time. This one thing requires a little bit of caution in interpreting it. It's a snapshot at a point in time rather than a tracing of a passage through time. Nevertheless, it's the best we have. We have to rely on this kind of thing, right? It's a snapshot at a point in time of the net financial assets held by households in different age cohorts. And I've given you two surveys here. One is the 1995 survey. The 98 one was somewhere in between the two of these and the 2001 survey. And the very interesting and important observation that we can make here is that quite clearly retired people try to hang on to their wealth. At most, there is only a very limited amount of decumulation or running down in savings. That's very clear in the 95 survey. In the 2001 survey, there's a small running down of savings. Now, one difficulty bear in mind is that today's 70-year-olds are different from yesterday's 70-year-olds, and tomorrow's 70-year-olds will be different from today's 70-year-olds. The major difference, I can tell you, is that tomorrow's 70-year-olds will be richer than yesterday's 70-year-olds. They'll have more wealth, and in that respect will probably be even less inclined and will need less so to decumulate, right? Now, the mouse cycle hypothesis would have suggested that the red line would come right down to zero, right? People accumulate wealth in their lifetime, and when they save it, the life saving hypothesis, the lifestyle hypothesis said that savings should be accumulated right down to zero. Quite clearly, people don't do that. And I would just say that people don't know how long they're going to live. People don't know how much prices are going to rise in the future. People don't know what health risks and health costs they might be faced with in the future. They therefore don't know at what rate they should accumulate their savings so that they're finally worth nothing on the day that they die. People don't have perfect foresight. You know, there's this idea of rational expectations and perfect foresight embedded in the views of lots of economists. It's really completely unrealistic. People can't make those estimations. People don't think like that. People don't behave like that. Now, as a consequence of that, wealth is going to become increasingly concentrated in the hands of the elderly. Professor Perturba, on the basis of the asset distribution amongst cohorts, as revealed in the 2001 survey, and given demographic projections, makes the following econometric forecasts. In the left chart, he looks at past and predicted shares of total financial assets. And the black line shows us that the 40 to 64 cohort in the population in 2001 is quite clearly the wealthiest, and that the retired cohort only have about half as many assets. In 2040, the blue line, they will have practically just the same amounts of wealth as the 40 to 45 cohort. So it's a very significant change in the share of wealth held in the economy. Even more pertinent, in the chart on the right, we have the past and predicted share of stock holdings in the economy. It's more important because financial assets include a lot of things that are not tradable. But stocks, of course, are important. They're a major thing that we invest in. Now, in 2001, approximately 55% of all shares would have been held by the 45 to 60 cohort. But less than 40% held by the over 65s. By the time we get to 2040, Professor Perturba predicts that the majority of company shares will be held by people over the age of 65. Those annual general meetings are going to become a very sleepy affair. Right. Perhaps over 50% will be held by 65 and overs, and only maybe 45% will be held by younger people. We want dividends. We're going to be telling those boards, increase your payout ratio and cut back on your extravagance. We want dividends. And that will also affect how companies are managed, I expect. Of enormous importance, only 1% of equity holders in the United States hold 50% of all equities. Here in Australia, on another measure, we saw 6% of people held 66% of all liquid wealth. What this tells us is that the savings or decumulation decision will be completely dominated by a small number of very wealthy people. It's not the people at the bottom end of the income spectrum who are going to make a difference. It's the wealthy who will determine this. And as I said, they will hold on to their assets. Now, looking at asset class returns, studies focus on direct links only, which may be a limitation of the studies. And there were two kinds of studies. There were simulation studies and empirical studies. A simulation model is a purely hypothetical construction. It's a purely, how should I put it? It's a purely conceptual model, right? It has no empirical basis. It simply says, given this following set of assumptions, we extrapolate from these assumptions what we would expect to happen. And the key assumption in that is the lifestyle hypothesis and decumulation. And because they presume decumulation, and we have the baby bulge progress of demographics in the last 50 years, and the projected aging of the population in the next 50 years, it follows mechanically from that set of assumptions. That is, the 40 to 65 cohort rose in the population, that increased savings and increased demand for investment will push up asset prices, And it would follow from that, that as that cohort diminished in the population, savings would dry out, people would sell their assets, and they would depress prices. However, when this matter is studied empirically, we find that empirically there is no support for that proposition. And there is actually apparently very little direct link between asset class returns on the one hand and changes in demographics on the other. So we conclude, well, I'm not going to entirely discount that there may be some link, but to the extent that there is a link, it's probably an indirect link. The aging of the population will slow economic growth, it will raise interest rates, probably reduce asset returns or corporate profits growth, net for asset returns. And therefore, it is probable that we might see some slowdown in returns in future years. But it's not obvious at all that asset prices will become depressed, and it's not obvious at all what the changes will be among certain asset classes. So there's actually very little that we can say today that has empirical support, and certainly the lifestyle hypothesis and the simulation studies don't. Now, looking at a rather distinct issue here, is there an age-specific set of asset preferences? I.e., do people really reorganize their portfolios in a big way once they retire? And once again, turning to the U.S. Survey of Consumer Finances for some help in this, we have here a chart that's based on the percentage of households responding to this particular survey. Please note, it's not the number of assets owned, it's simply the percentage of households who say they own either property or bonds or stocks or annuities. Okay, each household has the same weighting in the survey, irrespective of wealth. Now, once again, you have to bear in mind that this is a snapshot at a point in time, and that it doesn't trace the passage through time, and that tomorrow's 70-year-olds will be a little bit different from today's 70-year-olds. The first observation I think you can make about this chart, when you look at the 70 to 75 cohort, is that today's 70 to 75-year-olds worked and grew up in a period of time when the economies were less affluent. They didn't manage to save as much. Less of them have any assets over and above their home than we have today. And that's why you see the percentage holdings there in stocks and bonds and annuities. Well, so not annuities. The percentage holdings in stocks and bonds are lower than we found today in the younger cohorts. But the interesting thing is that the overall ranking and the preference for stocks over bonds does not change. People over the age of 75, a substantial majority, still prefer to hold on to stocks. There's no obvious switch in that chart from stocks to bonds. There's no obvious shift to, major shift to a so-called less risky profile, which is actually quite interesting. I'll come to some conclusion later. I don't want to repeat myself. Now, here in Australia, what evidence do we have? Well, our Melbourne Institute survey, once again, is a little bit different. It only asks for people's intentions on new savings rather than asking what are they going to do with their old savings. So that is a limitation. Nevertheless, what we see in this chart is that there is no obvious intention on the part of aged people to liquidate shares and move to bonds. We see that when we look at the red line. The most obvious thing to me in this chart is the black line, which is superannuation. Obviously, as people retire in the 55 to 64 age category, they withdraw their superannuation. And that's why that black line sinks down to practically nothing for the over 65s. What do they do with your superannuation? The chart would suggest that disproportionately it goes into bank deposits. Elderly people want a little liquidity, which is understandable. But interestingly enough, they invest a fair bit of it in real estate, and invest a fair bit of it in stocks. If you just remember from that previous chart, so one observation that we could have made in this previous chart is that notice how people hang on to their family home. People hang on to their family home for life or death. They never give it up. They want to die in their home, not in some hospice. In America, and to a lesser degree Australia today, financial arrangements allow people to draw a bit of equity out of their home. But people hang on to their real estate. And here in Australia, we found, once again, people hang on to their real estate, but they want to invest in shares, and they don't want to invest in bonds. Now, we conclude from that people want a bit of yield. Obviously, they've got to have a bit of yield. They need to live on something. But they also want protection against inflation. People don't know how long they're going to live, but today life expectancy for retired people is probably in order of 30 years. Even at 2.5% inflation, prices will double in approximately 29 years. I think it's 28.8 years to be exact. And people therefore don't want to see their income slipping in real terms year after year after year. They want protection against inflation. And therefore, however you look at it, bonds, fixed interest seem to be unpopular. We do see in America in that previous chart some small move into annuities. Some small move into annuities as people get older. There probably is some room for the life industry to pump annuities a bit harder than they have. Although I suspect annuities have been unpopular with a lot of people because of the element of capital capture, the loss of capital. I think there's a strong bequest thought or trend in our society. I think a lot of people want to leave their wealth to their family, to their children. I certainly do. I mean, in my opinion, to buy an annuity and gobble all my capital up and leave my sons nothing, to me, is a heart of selfishness. I just couldn't do it. Even if it means having to live in to suffer a lower standard of living. I don't think I'm the only one, quite frankly. So that basically covers that. Just looking briefly at what the latest new super reforms might mean. Quite clearly, the federal government has anointed superannuation as a chosen vehicle for long-term savings. Without a doubt. In the past, super has suffered from somewhat of a lack of interest, I would say. Geared property, other savings schemes, etc., competed quite strongly with superannuation. It always did surprise me how few people actually really took full advantage of superannuation. Just a matter of interest, if I can survey the people in this room, how many of you contribute more than the minimum necessary 5% into superannuation? Fantastic, you're all actuaries. Can I tell you what, I was in a presentation the other day, and I think that only about 3 out of 20 people put their hands up. There's a lot of people out there who will not contribute, and our industry was only 50%, just looking at you. It's about 50%. So, you know, not everyone out there historically has been convinced of superannuation. The introduction of choice and tax-free status post-60 should make superannuation the most attractive option for most Australians. But I would say the government does need to attend some of the inflexibility of superannuation. I don't know of many 20-year-olds who have a 40-year time horizon, quite frankly. And that's one of the problems. AMP anticipates an accelerating inflow into superannuation. I think investments in housing, the second home, the McMansion, is likely to be a big loser. That shift will come from investments in that second home or the investment property to superannuation. Within the super environment, there's no obvious winner in terms of asset classes. We will put the money into whatever assets seem most attractive on the day. Right? However, it probably could be observed that if the flow of funds becomes a problem for domestic markets, that there may well be an increased flow of funds abroad over time if domestic markets can't absorb the increased flow of funds. But that remains to be seen. Well, thank you, folks.
Thanks very much. Yes. Again, we probably have time for only one or two questions. So after that thought-provoking address, which certainly changed some of my perceptions about what happens in the decumulation stage, do we have any questions or comments?
Sorry, Martin. Anthony Asher. My reading of the academic research is that the investigations they've done are actually of financial assets, and they haven't included the implicit and real pension fund assets. so that if you take that into account, people actually do decumulate, but they do hold on if they've got shares outside their pension fund or outside the pension system, which in Europe and the States is actually very significant. Mm. It's earnings related, and it makes it, so they can live off their pensions, but that does effectively decumulate. And I think that does mean that there is likely to be a flow of assets, a flow of money outside the asset markets. But I agree with you entirely that it's not very easy to actually observe the link, because it's so distorted by all sorts of other flows. I mean, the very fact the strains that come from these pay-as-you-go schemes will mean that governments may be borrowing, which then distorts the market. And I would suggest at the moment that the biggest strain is actually the $1 trillion or more that's going to the oil producers that is distorting investment markets, because they've got to find somewhere to park it.
Your comment about the pension funds is correct. They don't include pension funds. In respect of pension funds and companies like the AMP who provided people with annuities, which is what you're talking about when you talk about accumulation, I wonder, though, whether we actually run down assets we hold in order to finance those annuities. I suspect we don't need to. The return we get from them is probably adequate. I strongly suspect that we don't find a rundown of the assets to provide those annuities.
Mike Barker, an excellent presentation, Alan. You focused a number of slides on the savings rate, that is the supply of capital. What about the other side, the demand for capital? You mentioned the economic growth rate. Which does that encompass it satisfactorily, or is it worth going into more detail on the demand, such as well, we know there's going to be lower demand for schools, perhaps higher demand for hospitals, and higher demand for roads for us grey nomads to drive around Australia. But is there have you got any better feeling for the overall demand for capital?
Well, capital is usually demanded when people can see a profitable opportunity. And thinking, you know, just fast forward to 2020, the rate of growth will be slower. You would think that there would be less profitable opportunities at that time. And faced with a higher real rate of interest for every given rate of growth, the hurdle that projects would have to pass to become profitable would be just that much higher. Yeah. Less profitable future cash flows to discount and a higher rate of discount. So my guess is that the demand for capital probably would be a little bit lower. That's why I said I can only say to you that the rate of interest will be higher for each and every given rate of growth, but that the rate of growth will be lower and the demand for capital will probably be lower, and therefore the rate of interest may not be much different, because we had a slower rate of growth at that time.
Thanks.